So the first presenter is Elisabeth Blatter-Seiber. Elisabeth Liz is a founding director of Duane Platter-Zeiberg & Company, and she's also the dean of University of Miami School of Architecture, where she taught and worked since 1979. She established a graduate program in that school and once again contributed in a variety of ways to reform and restructure the way we conceive urbanity, if you want, and the work that she had done and her colleague in the area of suburban development to writing, to presentation, and to very, very extensive design portfolio really influenced many, many people in North America. So without further ado, please listen.
Thank you, Avi. Good morning, everyone. I enjoyed very much our conversation last night and look forward to its continuation during the course of today and hope to get to know all of you a little bit better in the short time that I'll be here. In the very broad picture of world environments and health, this is a presentation about producing sustainable communities for the privileged end of the resource scale. I represent one extreme. I guess that's why I'm at the very beginning of this series, but it's truly only a partial picture. Avi, I commend you for the range of your short introduction and also the very cleverness and beauty of some of the images. In the setting of this conference, talking about improving the built environment and the health of the wealthy can only be justified insofar as it speaks to changing some of the models that influence global community development. This may sound a bit like the familiar refrain of the young architect, that working with patrons to invent new forms for houses on Long Island will result in improved forms of living for all, a theorem still to be proven. But urbanism, indeed, may be different, because while the Corbusian white box may not be ubiquitous in residential development, we do, however, see the American influence in the McMansions sprouting in the new suburbs of Chinese cities, for instance. And we have just read that Volvo is developing a larger, heavier, more costly automobile to take advantage of the growing Chinese market. I don't mean to pick on China. The point is here that a large part of the developing world is chasing the American suburban dream, which already observed to be unsustainable, nevertheless remains an attractive model. This underscores that what the first world does, and especially the United States, is an important influence on the rest of the world. We have the responsibility to get it right because, like it or not, we set the example. So with the following slides, I will speak to goals and principles, show some examples that are encouraging change in our world, and hopefully have time to reflect on next steps. And I would say that I am not somewhat uncustomarily not showing the problems of that American dream, but assuming that we already know what those are. So in some of the literature that we received at the outset, I believe this is Avi's list of what some of the topics are that we concern ourselves in sustainable settlements around the world. And I really will be speaking to public health and urban design, but obviously all of these things play a role. In our part of the world, the issues of public health really are a crisis of the privileged. If you want to make it simple, up to now we've understood that it has to do with smoking, our industrialized diet, and the sedentary lifestyle that Avi showed in several slides. Interestingly enough, we have reduced smoking through public policy, which resulted from data on the costs to public health of that practice. We still have to work on changing the development patterns that might change our food sourcing and help modify lifestyle to make healthier lifestyles. for instance, organic sources of food closer to home, and walking to destinations as part of early life, as well as having a public realm where those children might feel entertained and safe far away from television. So, of course, the perfect storm is our context. But it might be more interesting, instead of dwelling on that, to think a little bit about how we make change. And so this is three steps that a social scientist recently articulated for me. That the first step is social marketing, making the scenario, the future scenarios appealing and educating the public about that, beginning to facilitate that change by removing impediments, providing incentives and subsidies. I know this is very abstract, but by the end I will show this slide again with some clear illustrations. And then finally, instituting and institutionalizing the change through regulations that directly address the goal. And I would dare say that once again, this kind of change has to do with that part of society that can make choices and not other less fortunate conditions. So in the U.S., for instance, we have a number of organizations. These are just three that have been attempting in the last 20 years to deal with change in the built environment. Smart Growth, working on regional policies. The New Urbanism, working across scales. And the Green Building Council, beginning with buildings, but now also working with neighborhoods. And some 20 years ago, the Charter of the New Urbanism was written to call attention to the structure of the built environment. And that term, the New Urbanism, was actually coined for propaganda reasons. It was intended to bring people to attention, first in the U.S., and we hope further afield. And it deals, if you were to look at the fine print, you would say, you would see that we deal from goals at the regional scale to those at the neighborhood scale to the actual detail of street, block, and building. So at that middle scale, the neighborhood organization, that drawing on the left was done in the early 80s when some of us in architecture, urban design, and planning began to understand that the American dream of suburbia, the upper half of the left-hand slide, really had much to be desired, that there were problems attached to that, both in terms of environment, in terms of society and economy. And we drew what we understood to be an alternative to that, which was the traditional American town, which is the lower half of the slide. In the 80s, most of us who were educated in any degree about the built environment were not yet had not yet recovered the knowledge that existed in the early part of the 20th century. It was completely lost. That's a drawing of the ideal neighborhood structure by Clarence Perry, which was in the New York Regional Plan in the 1920s. And so we articulated five very broad principles for good neighborhood design. It needs to have a clear center and an edge. It doesn't need to be a New England town, but that's a good illustration for an edge. The dimensions are important. The quarter mile radius from center to edge, which is roughly a five-minute walk. The slide on the right is meant to show the importance of walking for in a society where we drive to everything for various age groups, children before the driving age and adults when they decide they no longer wish to drive. And in fact, it would be safer if our children didn't start driving at the age they do. That's the highest rate of death. The reason for death among teenagers is automobile accidents. Three, mix of uses finely grained. In that first diagram, you would have seen four or five different uses, but quite separated and only accessed by vehicles. In this case, that slide of Georgetown on the right, from the corner store through town apartments, townhouses, and the mansion within a few blocks, or even within a building, stores below, offices and residences above. I must say, showing all this now looks feels very obvious, but It's still really not in practice, and part of the education that we need to still be showing in the U.S. Street networks for pedestrian comfort, again, dimensions play a role, the size of the block that plays into the number of intersections per square mile or kilometer, an issue that many of you know about. The radius of the turning radius of the curb, the width of the sidewalk, the relationship to car and building. Civic places in focal locations where community life can come together easily without great effort. There is, of course, a sense of community in American suburbia, but at great cost, not only fuel cost, but the efforts that people make to come together. The post office in Princeton and, of course, churches and civic life play an important role. So more than 20 years ago already, a new community called Seaside in Florida's Panhandle began to play this role of education and appealing, presenting an appealing scenario, really without knowing at all where it was going or what its impact might be in the future. And it's known, of course, for its picturesque architecture, its relationship to the natural environment, but it also has reintroduced a realization that compact living, mixed use, and community gathering in public space, building the bonds of community, even though it is a resort, and has had a great effect on first communities, building new first communities, and indeed in rebuilding communities in the United States, and changing standards, for instance, some of our excessive engineering standards for streets and roads because of the examples that are there. So to fast forward, I will show you, because we are here in Montreal, two projects which emerged from this kind of thinking, and in contrast to their surroundings. And so I would just show you in Cornell, these are Google Maps, they're the best I could do, where there's a great deal of, where a large part of the plan was, in fact, to make the schools accessible to children directly from streets and through parks. One plan where you could imagine getting to this site almost from anywhere, quite directly here, but if you lived, for instance, as a child lived here, they would have to go out and have quite a roundabout route towards that destination, which is part of the structure of, and the same thing you would find in this older model, but this kind of interconnectedness of the plans, of these plans, are so important. And these places can be compact and charming and appealing as well. I believe these are all slides from Cornell, encouraging people to walk with a variety of public space and uses, including mixing uses in close proximity, which has been verboten in suburban models. And this model, of course, can aggregate. These are just some of the early propaganda drawings that were done in the last several decades, describing how an aggregation of neighborhoods with districts and corridors can make a healthy metropolitan area. Always very idealistic to get the point across, but we understand that in practice it's quite interesting to bring those ideals forward. And they've been worked at rather large regional scales. This is the Mississippi coast in a regional plan following Hurricane Katrina when the new urbanists, 150 new urbanists gathered to help 11 cities rebuild. From that full range, and here I am giving you the range of the charter for the new urbanism from region to individual building and the famed Katrina cottages, which were developed as emergency housing. I show this because this is actually a grow home, which is a concept which grew out of Montreal. And so while these ideas began with new places and migrated to cities and restructuring existing neighborhoods in decanted cities. Probably the largest challenge ahead of us is to look at those large areas of sprawl at the outside of our cities, which a number of people are now doing. Ellen Dunham Jones has a wonderful book on suburban retrofitting, and we're preparing a book of techniques. These are not the best drawings from it, but that just, I think, in very graphic mode, show you how one can begin to transform existing conditions, the single-use mall to a multi-use neighborhood. And then one of the very current ideas that people, and indeed practices that people are working on, is agricultural urbanism. This speaks to the production of food and the concern about food traveling. This is a kind of humorous approach to it, that a new urbanist town, such as you see in the background, very quickly introduced this idea, even as it was being built, by allowing certain kinds of food production to happen in this lower density setting. But the transect, which we, the idea of the rural to urban transect, which was initially developed to speak to the developing of the detailing of various densities in the metropolitan continuum, has developed also a module to deal with agriculture, from large-scale farming to window boxes, and I'm sure we'll hear later in the day, agriculture in high-density urban buildings. And this is one of the early sketches from a project actually on the western edge of Canada near Vancouver, which Larry knows, called Southside, which shows a kind of purposeful integration of farming with living, understanding all the problems that the farmers have educated us about integrating, but in with propaganda drawings like these that begin to show you the different, the transect of possible farming food and food production conditions from low to high density. But now, this is the part of my talk that I think might be most interesting to you, which is in the state of Florida, some of my colleagues at the University of Miami and the Department of Public Health, School of Architecture and Public Health, working with the Surgeon General of the state, trying to promote health in communities without developing a costly, some sort of costly program. And it was decided that rewarding communities for their walkability might be a good idea. And so this is a program which is already in use. I won't read all the fine print for you there. In fact, some communities have already begun to measure themselves and to promote themselves in this way, but there will be a certificate coming from the Surgeon General once, I believe one of my colleagues is speaking to the Governor's Council about this week. And the hope is, of course, that by pointing out the walkability and the healthiness of a community, that the business, the economic life of that community, the desire for people to be there and businesses to be there might be increased, thus giving these kinds of communities a better position economically than others, and in that oblique way, causing change to happen. So there is a set of criteria, and I will quickly take you through just one of them, of course, scoring and certification. But there, this is the way, pretty much the way the page looks for the citizen or a community inhabitant who might be looking at their own community, and including defining the issue. There's also a rationale that reflects back to the data by which that criteria was chosen. So in terms of connectivity, it's the calculation of the percentage of intersections, and it's very easily done. You don't need to hire an architect or a planner. You can go to Google. In this case, measuring the intersections. 23 of this neighborhood's 44 intersections are four-way intersections, which is a 52% score on this criteria. So we're kind of excited about this way of promoting change without necessarily costing anyone very much. Another project that I was involved with is changing the code of the city of Miami on a transect-based form-based code, a vision for its future, and the most important part is this transit-oriented, pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use. This is the definition of a city, isn't it? It's almost laughable that we have to try to convince the population and politics of a city that this is a good idea, but indeed, it took 4 years to change the code with any number of public meetings which use techniques such as I just showed you there. It's much more complicated than I can explain today, but it is an enormous example for American cities. So coming back to that original idea of how do you make change, you know, the social marketing is underway. So if we review these three phases in cultural change, social marketing, the removal of barriers, incentivizing change, and its institutionalization in the laws of the land, the new urbanism has played a role in the social marketing phase of changing development patterns in the U.S. We are now far into the implementation phases of removing barriers and regulating, and not a minute too soon, as Avi pointed out. The growing acknowledgement of the need to make our built environment more sustainable and healthy presents a context of ferment and opportunity. Development patterns that mitigate energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions and encourage a healthier daily lifestyle are no longer merely a matter of choice. I will end with a word of caution, however. History repeats itself because we forget. If you were to consult any number of issues of the Craftsman magazine, a flagship of the progressive era a century ago, you would see that contemporary concerns were even then in the public discourse. A kind of forgetfulness, however, results from losing touch with experience, a simple loss of knowledge. History teaches us that loss of knowledge can occur with loss of momentum. Taking stock of the new urban models that present a healthier, more efficient, and sustainable future for community development, one cannot help but also be aware of the last several decades of enabling economic conditions. These are now behind us, and there is uncertainty ahead. Our momentum seems to be slowing. The first decades of the 20th century, when still admired garden cities such as Marymount, Forest Hills, and Coral Gables were built, was followed by a period of inactivity long and distracted enough that when building resumed after World War II, the capacity to bring to scale that model of community building was totally and dementedly lost. We may be at the start of another drought, hopefully not of similar proportion. My hope is that the continuing life of numerous organizations and publications, perhaps new partnerships such as you're trying to instill here, will serve as a bridge of knowledge, a record of what needed to be overcome in our time, of successfully implemented solutions and their timeless lessons. So perhaps it's not, I'm skipping forward to save you time, but perhaps it's not an engagement in hubris to declare that we can see a future of wiser, healthier, more efficient, and more beautiful placemaking in one part of the world. What remains to be seen is whether we can have a helpful influence elsewhere and whether we can retain this knowledge without forgetfulness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for putting the presentation. Thank you. We will have a chance to respond and to comment and to have discussion following Ian's presentation.